You're listening to the CamCam Books podcast with your hosts, Cameron and Tricia McManus.
All right, we're moving along with Canto 16. And the Dante Daily today is?
Politics Cannot Save You.
Okay, and you said this is a continuation of this subcircle of hell, which is violence against God.
That's correct, and that's something to get used to. Those of you who are really keeping score may notice that we're already in the seventh circle, and you might note that there are only nine altogether. We're going to be spending a lot of time in these last few circles.
And how timely that this be yes. Very political, common good conversation.
And lest you think, oh, well, it's hardly topical, you're just deliberately working it into that because this is the one you're doing this week. I think listeners should know, I write the Dante Dailies well in advance. Like, I've got halfway through Purgatorio written up, so this really is Providence.
Canto 16. Now was I, where was heard the reverberation of water falling into the next round, like to that humming which the beehives make, when shadows three together started forth, running from out a company that passed beneath the rain of the sharp martyrdom. Towards us came they, and each one cried out, "Stop thou, for by thy garb to us thou seemest to be someone of our depraved city."
One thing to note here is that even though we're in a very low circle of hell, these souls are good enough that they can still hate real vice. That's why they make that comment about Florence being a depraved city.
Ah me, what wounds I saw upon their limbs, recent and ancient by the flames burnt in. It pains me still but to remember it. Unto their cries my teacher paused attentive. He turned his face toward me. And, "Now wait," he said, "to these we should be courteous. And if it were not for the fire that darts the nature of this region, I should say that haste were more becoming thee than them." As soon as we stood still, they recommenced the old refrain, and when they overtook us, formed of themselves a wheel, all three of them, as champions stripped and oiled are wont to do, watching for their advantage of their hold, before they come to blows and thrusts between them. Thus, wheeling round, did every one his visage direct to me, so that in opposite wise his neck and feet continual journey made.
So what happens here is that we see a group of three souls. They see Dante, and because they can't stop moving, but they want to talk with him, the solution they come up with is to continually move in a circle. So they kind of circle back towards him, stand near him because they can't stand still because of this hot sand. They each keep going in circles. And note that Dante likens them to wrestlers waiting for their advantage. That's a very important image because, as we're going to see, these three men are Florentine politicians. So they're expert warriors in the political realm.
And if the misery of this soft place bring in disdain ourselves and our entreaties, began one, and our aspect black and blistered, let the renown of us thy mind incline to tell us who thou art, who thus securely thy living feet dost move along through hell. He in whose footprints thou dost see me treading, naked and skinless, though he now may go, was of a greater rank than thou dost think. He was the grandson of the good Gualdrada. His name was Guido Guerra, and in life much did he with his wisdom and his sword. The other, Tegiayo Aldobrandi, is, whose fame above there in the world should welcome be. And I, who with them on the cross am placed, Jacopo Rusticucci was, and truly my savage wife, more than aught else, doth harm me.
We're going to pause for a while on this one. There's a lot we need to know about these three men in order to understand the Dante Daily and the point of bringing them in. Okay, the first two figures kind of go together. So Guido Guerra and Taggiajo were both Florentine politicians. One particular episode will demonstrate their wisdom, and it actually involves a figure we've already seen. So you may remember Farinata from way back in the Circle of Heretics, you know, that proud guy kind of disdaining all of hell. So he got exiled from Florence, and he ended up leading an army of his political faction against another one. So then the main ruling party in Florence kind of got together to have a big battle to sort of say, let's take out Farinata, let's take out all these other guys. So Guido Guerra and Taggiajo, they both advised against this, and their wisdom was very much borne out, because this was the Battle of Montepetri. It's the bloodiest battle in medieval Florence. It was a total devastating loss against Farinata. So bringing them up here, these really were wise people, and had the city heeded their political advice, it would have done better. The third figure, Jacopo, although he was not involved in that particular conflict, also has a reputation as a sort of wise figure. And then we note that little throwaway line at the end. He says that my savage wife more than aught else doth harm me. So we've been in this particular circle, encountering sinners of Sodom, for several cantos now, and this is the first line that what they actually did is in any way even implied or hinted at. So what is Dante trying to get at here? Well, really, it's the Dante Daily. Politics alone cannot save you. Consider, these were two legitimately good men. The rest of the canto is going to continue to emphasize this. Dante is going to pay them honor. He's not going to spit on them and talk about how awful they are. They really tried to do well for their city. They actually were men of wisdom. They had lots of virtues in this particular area. And yet, simply because we take Jacopo's line where he basically blames his wife for his sin, we have little ears, so I won't unpack what's going on there. But no, that seems like a small thing. Well, he was such a good guy. He did so many good things for the city. So what if there was one sin that he couldn't take responsibility for? So what if he goes into his eternity blaming his wife for something that wasn't her fault? But the point Dante's making is that as good as a man as you are, if you are gripping on to one sin, even if that sin isn't like the center of your whole identity, it's enough, because you either have to take God 100% or you have to completely reject him. Even if you retain a lot of your virtues otherwise, even if you retain a lot of your good qualities, if you aren't willing to embrace God with both arms, that means leaving all the sins behind. It means embracing goodness itself without asterisks or reservations. If you're not willing to do that, you are rejecting heaven. And that really is Dante's point. So politics for him is much more closely connected to the life of virtue than it would be to a modern. Like, for a lot of us, we think of politics almost as kind of separate from moral life. In medieval times, this was not so. But this is really the key point. Even good medieval politicians, right, in officially Catholic states, what Dante's getting at is that even that is not quite enough. You can be a great man, you can do a lot of good for your city, but at the end of the day, even one little sin that you're refusing to let go of, that can be enough to come between you and God.
Could I have been protected from the fire below, I should have thrown myself among them, and think the teacher would have suffered it. But as I should have burned and baked myself, my terror overmastered my goodwill, which made me greedy of embracing them. Then I began, sorrow and not disdain did your condition fix within me so, that tardily it wholly is stripped off. As soon as this my lord said unto me words on account of which I thought within me, that people such as you are were approaching.
So much honor does Dante think these hellish souls deserve, that what he says is that he almost wanted to throw himself into the fire with them. And he thinks that Virgil might even have allowed him, but he was too afraid. And then when he begins to speak to them, the first thing he does is actually kind of apologizes for his initial reaction. He wants to make sure they understand that the face he made when he was looking at them was based on sorrow for their condition and not disdain. And that's a really important point because, as we've talked about before, this deepens the tragedy. As bad as it is to be in the bottom circle of hell or close to it and known widely as a thoroughly rotten individual, it's much worse when you see what the person could have been. You see these tragic figures that could have been incredible saints but failed to be. That's really the contrast this is trying to underline.
I of your city am, and evermore, your labors and your honorable names, I with affection have retraced and heard. I leave the gall and go for the sweet fruits, promised to me by the voracious leader. But to the center first I needs must plunge. So may the soul for a long while conduct those limbs of thine. Did he make answer then, and so may thy renown shine after thee. Valor and courtesy say if they dwell within our city as they used to do, or if they wholly have gone out of it. For Guglielmo Borsier, who is in torment with us of late, and goes there with his comrades, doth greatly mortify us with his words.
What they're asking Dante here is if Florence is still good. And note that they identify political good with moral goodness. They are asking if the citizens are virtuous. The reason they ask is that Borsier, who is a not very well-known nobleman to us now, but basically is another member of their political class, he's died and come down there recently, and what they're hearing from him is not good news. So they're hoping that Dante can correct the record, but unfortunately, he's telling the truth.
The new inhabitants and the sudden grains, pride and extravagance have in thee endangered Florence, so that thou weep'st thereat already. In this wise I exclaim with face uplifted, and the three, taking that for my reply, looked at each other, as one looks at truth. If other times so little it doth cost thee, replied they all, to satisfy another, happy art thou, thus speaking at thy will. Therefore, if thou escape from these dark places and come to re-behold the beauteous stars, when it shall pleasure thee to say, I was, see that thou speak of thus unto the people. Then they broke up the wheel, and in their flight it seemed as if their agile legs were wings.
Dante is making here a really profound statement about the value of poetry. So what happens in these lines is they say, should there ever come a time when you're out of hell, and you can say of this moment that it was in the past, please tell those who are still above about us. Now, we're reading these lines. It really happened. He wrote a poem about it just as they asked. Why emphasize this? Well, consider these are really good men, as far as Dante can see, who still did not manage to become saints, did not manage to go to heaven. And I think one of the anxieties that he has as a poet is, what do you do for people that you admire that you don't think became saints? You can hardly, you know, ask them to pray for you or anything like that. What he's kind of saying is that although they might not have the eternal spiritual life that we hoped for them, they can have a kind of eternal literary life. You can immortalize them in poetry. And that is kind of what he's saying is, to some extent, the point of what he's doing with the Inferno. It's not just a theological story. It allows him to do a good turn to people who are otherwise, you know, we can't help them by our prayers, but maybe we can help them by our poetry. It's a really tragic idea in a way, but bittersweet.
Not an amen could possibly be said so rapidly as they had disappeared. Wherefore the master deemed best to depart. I followed him, and little had we gone before the sound of water was so near us that speaking we should hardly have been heard. Even as that stream which holdeth its own course, the first of Monte Veso towards the east, upon the left-hand slope of Apennine, which is above called Aquaceta, ere it down descendeth into its low bed, and at Forli is vacant of that name, reverberates there above the San Benedetto, from Alps, by falling at a single leap, where for 1,000 there were room enough. thus downward from a bank precipitate, we found resounding the dark-tinted water, so that it soon the ear would have offended. I had a cord around me girt, and therewithal I whilom had designed to take the panther with the painted skin.
It's going to be a little tricky to follow what's going on here. So Dante's left those politicians. He's moved with Virgil a little further, and they've come to this precipice that goes down very, very far, and there's sort of dark water at the bottom. Now, Dante mentions that he's wearing a cord, basically like a belt, and he mentions that he had previously planned to use this belt as a leash to grab the panther. Now, we might remember all the way back in the very first episode of all of this, Dante, when he was in the Dark Wood, was being attacked by various beasts symbolizing various different vices. So this is a deeply symbolic moment. So the cord that he had hoped to tame this beast with, he's now going to throw it into the water because Virgil will tell him to do so. And then this cord is going to help them tame another beast who's going to rise up out of the water. Now, we're going to meet this creature in the next canto. If you can't wait and want to start putting some of the symbolism together, okay, so it's a belt, there's a panther. What is the beast? The beast symbolizes fraud, which is going to be the next circle that we're getting into.
After I this had all from me unloosed, as my conductor had commanded me, I reached it to him, gathered up and coiled. Whereat he turned himself to the right side, and at a little distance from the verge, he cast it down into that deep abyss. It must needs be some novelty respond, I said within myself, to the new signal the master with his eye is following so. Ah me! How very cautious men should be with those who cannot alone behold the act, but with their wisdom look into the thoughts. He said to me, soon there will be upward come what I await, and what thy thought is dreaming must soon reveal itself unto thy sight. Aye, to that truth which has the face of falsehood, a man should close his lips as far as may be, because without his fault it causes shame. But here I cannot, and, reader, by the notes of this my comedy, to thee I swear, so may they not be void of lasting favor. Athwart that dense and darksome atmosphere, I saw a figure swimming upward come, marvelous unto every steadfast heart, even as he returns who goeth down, sometimes to clear an anchor, which has grappled reef, or aught else that in the sea is hidden, who upward stretches and draws in his feet.
And we end this canto with a sort of evocative hinting at a monster that's going to feature prominently in our next canto. And that takes us to the end.
Okay. So tell me, why did you choose Politics Cannot Save You?
Well, Really, it's the point Dante's trying to make with this canto, because the souls that he's chosen to profile are Florentine politicians, and that's not unusual. We've met a few of these already. Mm-hmm. But he's particularly choosing to profile ones that he thinks were good politicians, right? Mm. That, and another key point here is that this is the Middle Ages, so it would be beyond anachronistic for us to say, oh, so he thought, you know, politicians should be left-wing or politicians should be right-wing. Ideology just does not play that role in medieval politics. It's not how they conceive of the things. Really what it is these were wise men who made good decisions, and the city would have been better off had they followed their decisions. That's really how Dante envisions them. But what he's noting is that as good as they were, that wasn't salvation for them. And the point is even stronger when we understand how they officially approached politics. So, generally speaking, in the modern era, the official reason that we're supposed to be doing politics in Western democracies is freedom. Now, I don't mean by that all the parties necessarily have the same concept of freedom, mm-hmm. or they agree about everything, but basically that is ostensibly what's supposed to justify everything you do. Even if you make the appeal cynically, you're supposed to appeal to freedom in order to justify your policies. In medieval Florence, virtue has the same place in political conversation that freedom does now. That doesn't mean that they were all pious and noble and wonderful, but they were drawing from Aristotle, who saw basically the purpose of the state was to ensure the common good, and for Aristotle, fundamentally, the common good was the virtuous life. There was a bit more to it than that. There was a sort of shared life of friendship, but basically the state's job was to not produce moral goodness, but to create circumstances that made this easier to pursue.
Right. And I think the big difference between then and now is that we don't have a shared understanding of what virtue is.
There's actually a really profound point in that. So it's twofold. If we think of that buzzword now, virtue signaling, before going into, here's an example and here's an example, just think for a moment, what does the term actually refer to? Putting aside any criticism of whether they should do it, generally speaking, what people are actually signaling when they quote-unquote virtue signal is not a virtue. They're signaling an opinion.
Yeah, they're saying, I'm on your side. Look at this. I put this flag up. I put that flag up. Don't worry. We're in alliance. We're in accordance.
Like, but no one really virtue signals how courageous they are or how much self-control they have. There would be problems with that. But, like, it's not... We don't even have this notion that moral life consists of anything other than the correct positions on moral issues.
Well, that's just it. Correct positions. Mm-hmm. Well, when we're talking about virtue, it should be correct for all.
Mm.
Where when we're talking about virtue signaling, we're saying, which camp are you in?
Yeah.
Don't worry. I'm an ally. I'm on your side.
And of course, Florentine politics, one thing should be clear now. There were big feuds. There were certainly factions. But what separated the Guelphs and Ghibellines, although it was an ideological issue, it was almost family ties, too. It was really like, this is my side, not so much this is my ideology. There was an element of that, but it's the key point is that the reason that Dante thinks that these figures that he's profiled are so good is not because they really pursued Guelph or Ghibelline beliefs. It's basically because they were virtuous men that made good decisions. The good decision that they're best known for is not going into a battle that actually did end very badly for Florence. There's no ideology on that, right? They just said they made the right call. They were wise men.
I feel like we're kind of jumping back and forth from...
The medieval world and the modern
medieval
world.
Medieval world and the modern world. Bringing it to the modern world, I'm thinking of your Dante Delius, politics cannot save you. It's interesting you put it that way because I feel like being in the time and place that we are right now, it is... October 28th, 2024, and we are living in the eastern part of the United States.
Election's in a few days.
The most intense part. The election is in a few days. People are living as though their lives depend on it. Anytime I think of American politics, one of the first campaigns I think of is, who was it? Vote or die. Who is that? Kanye West. Vote or die.
Vote or die. I didn't even know that was his campaign.
Yeah, that was his campaign. It wasn't him running, but it was for him to... He was just, encouraging people to get out and vote. That's how I see people living right now. It's you vote or you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think the grounding in this is that when we think of what politics, the function of it, in Aristotle's words, were to ensure a common good, to ensure the common good. And back then it wasn't about living virtuous life because they didn't have Christ. They didn't know, Aristotle didn't know Jesus.
Yeah, a pagan sense of virtue.
A pagan sense of virtue, but a virtue nonetheless that no one can disagree on what virtue is or was. But now there is, and I love that concept that you brought up of virtue signaling, which is, of course, fake virtue, and flaunting it for the masses, which is, not very humble at all, but just ensuring, just so you know, we're on the same side. But if we think of what we're voting for...
Precisely because voting is marketed to us this way, we kind of imagine that we're like world emperor choosing the president.
Right.
And I think sometimes that's how we approach the voting, because we say, I have to decide between the lesser of two evils. we don't realize that you're not actually really deciding. I mean, you are in a sense deciding whether to vote for one or the other, but you're not deciding between the lesser of two evils in that, like, your vote decides, you know, whether we get this bad candidate or that worse candidate.
I think, to that point, I think when family members disagree, and the fight that occurs between the two of them, as if that vote really mattered, as if your sister or your brother's vote would have turned the tide so that suddenly your candidate is off the ballot, you know, that it's... Is it worth fighting for on that level?
And I know that people, when they hear this, they say, oh, but it is the votes that actually elect the candidates, right? It's all families doing this that actually lead to it. But you still have to have a sense of when it's in your personal, moral, spiritual life, we're talking about one or two or three grains of sand in the enormous pile. Okay. Yes, the enormous pile is made of millions of grains of sand, but that's the point. It's made of millions. It's not made of two. So have some perspective on how your particular family votes actually affect things.
But then getting to the point deeper, it's that are our hearts in the right place? Keeping our heads on straight about what the whole point is.
I think that's really important because I wouldn't want people to misunderstand. The Dante Daily, and the point Dante's making here, is not that politics are totally unrelated to your spiritual life. It's not as though, oh, don't worry about what you believe politically. It's all... any possible ideology that you might follow is totally compatible with a relationship with God. That's not the point. The point is that politics alone are not enough. They're important because they form some of the raw material that makes up your spiritual life, if that raw material metaphor makes sense. Like, who's president does affect the laws of your country, and the laws of your country are going to sometimes provide that raw material for, like, it might be the occasion of a particular cross or a particular temptation. So that's true.
Well, I think of an example of that is, you know, the particular chief of police in the city in which we live. Great. He's a good guy. But if I'm leaving my doors unlocked and my windows wide open and I go on vacation, I'm leaving my house in danger.
That is a perfect image for what Dante is getting at, because that's precisely it. Look, these guys that we saw in the canto, they had it all right. They knew how to make good political conditions for Florence and did their best to do it, and they ended up in hell. And it's not because of their politics. It's, I mean, we say, you know, Jacopo there, it's because he blames his wife for the thing that separated him and God. It's because of actually a little thing. But the point is that it's those little things or the big things that actually are what come between you and God.
So moms and dads, bringing it back to you being the heads of state in your own home. You are the rule makers. You are going to do so much more forming your children and forming your own souls than your vote could ever do.
That is, I think, an excellent way to look at it. So I really want to underline what you said there, darling. This is not just a nice idea. It actually is Catholic doctrine and Aristotle's philosophy. Your home, your family, that's a mini state. So political life, your political energies, they actually need to be directed at first making that country the kind of country that produces saints. That has to be where it starts. So who wins this election is relevant in the way that who becomes, you know, Holy Roman Emperor in the Middle Ages or the president of the UN is relevant to heads of state of countries, but it's foreign affairs. It's not actually home policy, right? It's going to affect how you interact with the other mini states. It might affect them very badly.
But you are the ruling. You run the home.
So I think I would frame the question this way. When we're thinking about the results of the election, which we will know hopefully very within soon. A few days, ask yourself this. So first envision that your favorite candidate wins, that you get all the policies that you're hoping for and all of that kind of thing. Okay, great. Does that guarantee the salvation of you, your spouse, and your children? Then ask yourself, and this is where things are going to get tricky, suppose the other candidate wins. Does that other candidate winning imperil any of your salvations? And I think that sometimes if we actually really compare you know, you don't want to hope for bad stuff. But I think if you actually compare what's the pursuit of holiness going to be like in these two different regimes, you might actually find yourself saying, you know, there are some ways in which a bad president can, because God does this through his providence, can be helpful to spiritual life, because mm-hmm. it will mean crosses. It will mean that people
on people's radar.
It means you can't become comfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, consider Jacopo and all of his friends there. They got comfortable. Mm-hmm. That's why they went. Like, it's not some
they weren't fighting for anything.
Well, they're not like Farinata, where they've got, like, you know, these deep-seated things that make them reject God. Like, basically, they're still good enough that they can actually love some virtues and hate some vices, but they just didn't go all the way. We have to imagine they got comfortable. They just focused on doing well for the city, and they mm-hmm. figured this vice, oh, whatever, I'll just carry on with it. Yeah.
There is a beauty in struggle, not that we wish it, mm-hmm. you know, but there is... I guess what you could be saying is that no matter what the outcome, the most important thing is that we strive for holiness right here at mm-hmm. home and let that flow over into society.
Yeah. I mean, I'll put it this way, only because in every election, and I think, unfortunately, this might go on for the next 1,000 years, in every election, somebody or both people get compared to Hitler at some point. But consider, okay, in Nazi Germany, St. Maximilian Kolbe was able to become a saint. Mm-hmm. Now, no one wants to live in such a world. Mm-hmm. But do understand, this is what we say when we're saying politics is not going to save you. It's the raw material. But the saving is going to come from God primarily and from you letting him save you.
So on that note, God bless you, our American friends.
Yes, indeed.
We are praying very much for this, but no matter the outcome, holiness can be achieved mm-hmm. in both ways, and that if you get who you want, don't become complacent.
Yes.
Make sure you're striving and ruling in the most important place, and that's your very own soul mm-hmm. and in your very own home.
And I invite you to pray this intention on your own. It's the one that we're taking. Don't just pray for the country to have just laws. Mm-hmm. Pray for the citizens to go to heaven. Because at the end of the day, we could have the most just, prosperous society in human history. But it's not going to matter at all if it doesn't help us get to our eternal life.
Thanks for listening to the CamCam Books podcast. Follow us on Instagram @CamCamBooks.